Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. If you're watching or if you're listening to this podcast, please remember to like it, to leave a review. Every little bit helps. Today, my guest is Miguel Jeté, and he's all about AI. In fact, he's currently developing a speech-to-text transcription solution that ensures that we're all understood without bias. I'm tired of having to repeat myself when I ask Siri something, so hopefully he can do something about that too. But I'm interested to learn more about how he came to AI and what he hopes to do next. So welcome to Teach the Geek Interviews, Miguel.
Thank you. Yeah, nice to be here.
I saw from a bit of research I did on you that you got a degree. You got degrees in math and computer science. So what was the interest in getting those degrees?
Yeah. I started actually, I'm French Canadian, and I wanted to learn English more. So I went to university in English. My first degree was in biology. But I quickly learned that biology has a lot of complicated terms, and you know, learning biology in your second language was pretty difficult. And the best classes that I had in that first year were math and computer science, because you know, mathematics is kind of a universal language, and so I really did well in those classes. I always did well in math and was always interested in computers, so kind of naturally, like I guided myself toward that degree. It's just mathematics is kind of a universal language, I guess. I liked it.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I commend you for even getting a degree in a second language in the first place. The idea of me even trying to do it was hard enough for me to get the degree in my first language, my only language. So getting one in a second language, damn, kudos to you.
Thanks. Yeah, it was maybe a bit foolish, but it was interesting.
But yeah. I saw you got a master's as well. So what was the reason to get the master's?
Yeah, so as I went along, you know, I started to specialize a little bit in my classes. So I did a double major, computer science and mathematics at McGill. And then near the end, I took more and more specialized classes towards what's called phylogenetics. So it was the study of the mathematical structure of evolutionary trees. And so, you know, when you're studying evolution and you look at these phylogenetic trees, they have mathematical properties. And so we're starting to look at that. And one of the teachers was this really cool, you know, at the time I was 23 years old, this guy was 28 or so. He was super young and super cool guy. And so I really enjoyed working with him. And so I decided to do a master's with him and just to kind of continue my studies in that field. And so at first I was studying evolutionary biology, basically. So I kind of went back to my biology roots, but with a mathematics kind of twist.
Okay. Was there ever an idea of even going further and getting a PhD, or was master's enough for you?
No, there was. I think I was kind of interested, but just near the end of my studies. So I finished those studies with David in New Zealand. And so I did a year abroad over there, more or less. And then I don't know when I finished, a friend of mine, JP, was working in the field of speech recognition and AI at a company in Montreal called Nuance. And he was saying like, hey, this is a really cool field. And, you know, we have an open position. You should join. And I guess at the time, you know, my wife was going to do a PhD and I was getting it all a bit, you know, tired of school. So I think I just kind of like saw an opportunity and like, you know, went for it. But yeah, I was always interested in a PhD, maybe a bit later.
Okay. Yeah, I can relate. I actually started a PhD program, but I left after the first year. And it was because I was tired of being poor. You don't make money when you're in a PhD program, especially when I'm looking at all the guys I went to undergrad with, and they're buying houses, they're buying stuff, and they're having, you know, they're getting on with their life, and I'm still eating ramen noodles. Like, nah, man. It's ridiculous. I want to make money too.
Yeah, there was a bit of that for sure. Yeah.
100%. All right. So now you finish with school. You have a bachelor's degree. You got a master's degree. Now it's time to go out in the workplace. What type of work did you do when you left school?
Yeah. So I joined that company, Nuance. And I really have to say, it was a good decision. I really lucked out because I had studied AI and, you know, and mathematics and computer science. McGill program had a lot of good foundational classes in those topics, but I didn't really study that in my master's. But the topic was so interesting. So when I joined Nuance, I started to learn a lot about speech recognition, kind of on the fly, and a lot of the mathematics behind were very similar, because when you're studying by the field I was in was the bigger field was called bioinformatics, and in that field you study a lot of DNA sequences and you try to align these DNA sequences and so on, and it's very similar in speech recognition. You're studying sequences of events. And so, yeah, I got into speech recognition and you know, that was 17 years ago, and it feels like I kind of joined at the right time because things were just starting, you know, so it was really fascinating to see the whole kind of progress since then.
So when we start from where you started to where you are now, the changes that you've made throughout your career, were they all planned? Or were they things that kind of came up and you saw opportunities and you kind of went for them?
Yeah, they were definitely opportunities that I saw. Feels definitely a bit random, you know. When you look back, you know, you can kind of obviously you can see the path, and it may not seem random, but at the time, I think like a lot of the, you know, there's some great achievements, some lucky, you know, networking event that made me meet the right person and so on. I always thought like, yeah, I mean, I want to remain flexible, you know, and meet people and see kind of like pursue things that seem interesting. So I didn't move that much throughout my career, actually. So I guess I see myself as a pretty loyal person, but you know, my first 8 years were at Nuance, and then there's this company in Seattle called VoiceBox that seemed really interesting. And they came kind of at a good time where I was ready for a change. And so they were doing speech recognition in car. So they had a contract with Toyota, and it just seemed like a cool kind of challenge, you know. So we moved across the continent from Montreal to Seattle. And then 2 years after that, I gained a lot of experience, and Rev approached me. And again, it seemed like an interesting challenge for different reasons. And I was just ready for that challenge. So I took it. But yeah, I kind of like remain in those three companies so far in my career. So I guess I chose well, but you know, I did leave the door like open for these opportunities to come.
Nice. And that's the way to do it. I mean, there is something to be said about staying in one place for your entire career, but how often does that happen these days? I mean, that's pretty much something from the past, especially now where you hear of so many people getting laid off of these various companies. You know, they may have been there a number of years, and they have thought they would be there a number of years more, and then you get the call saying, yeah, that's not going to be the case. Today's your last day. It's like, what are you going to do now? And you got to have to figure it out. So, yeah, being flexible and just kind of rolling with the punches, I think, is really helpful when it comes to just your work life and just advancing throughout your career. Just, yeah, like I said, being flexible and just knowing that, you know, something else is going to come along, and it could be just as good as what you just left.
Yeah, and you know, throughout my career, I wouldn't say I'm like an amazing networking person, but I do enjoy meeting new people, you know, and like chatting and stuff. So I just, you know, you make friends in that field, and I think that really helps over time, you know, keep connections alive. And
100%, Miguel. And I think a lot of people that lost their jobs in the tech industry, they didn't put enough effort into building networks when they had jobs. So now they're leaving. Now they don't have a job. And it's always hard. It's always harder to find a job when you don't have a job because you don't have as much leverage. So if you'd had that network from before, you could just throw out the bat signal. I'm out of a job now, people. Come help me. And then you can have a job. There are people that I knew, that I know, that lost their jobs as well during this time. They had another job within a month. I mean, it was right. Quick. That's a couple of pay periods, man. I don't even know they applied for unemployment. They got a job that quickly because they're very well connected. They basically reached out to their networks, and their networks went to work for them. But it's really difficult to then build a network when you actually need the network. It's way easier to have the network and then use the network or leverage the network when you need it, as opposed to having to build it as you go. I think a lot of people are finding that out now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. That makes total sense.
Oh, yeah. So I mentioned in the intro that you're working on this solution that has to do with speech to text transcription. I mean, obviously, you can't give us too much details about it, but from what you can say about it, what's that solution about?
Yeah, well, yeah. So when I was saying I joined Rev, now 7 years ago, and when Rev approached me, I can tell you a bit about Rev, you know, and give you some background, and it will all make sense. But when Rev approached me 7 years ago, Rev was founded 12 years ago, so it had been around for five six years when I joined, and they were doing they may hate me for saying this, but they had what I used to describe as Uber for transcription. So it's a work from home. It was a work from home marketplace where, you know, you can work for Rev as a transcriber, a subtitler, from home, you know, and you transcribe and, you know, when you need to make some money, or, you know, Rev kind of like became this like leader in speech text, you know, provider over the years, and they accumulated a lot of training material for AI. But at the time when I joined, Rev was not doing any sort of AI services. But they knew, they had the foresight, they knew that, you know, the AI industry would one day start to disrupt, you know, their human, you know, marketplace, if you will, as speech recognition would get better and better. And they were always interested in providing the best service possible for their customers. And so they hired me to start looking into speech recognition for them. And at the time, you know, I already had, you know, a 10-year background in the subject. And so I joined exploring this. And what's amazing at Rev is, because they have now, you know, 12, 13 years of experience in the field and all this sort of varied data, they have, I think, to this day, the most interesting speech to text data set for training in AI, because they have a super varied data set from, you know, people like me who speak, you know, second language, first language French, but, you know, they have super diverse data set. that was transcribed by a very diverse set of people. The Revers, we have 75,000 people working on our platform, and it creates this this training set for an AI that has the potential of being way less biased, you know, towards, you know, just like main English speakers, or, you know, I don't know how to say properly, but and so we've been exploring, you know, building this speech text AI for the last 7 years, and I think in the last 2 years or so, we've released what I think is the least biased speech recognition model around. And it's now being used by a lot of people. Like we have, you know, pretty big customers like Vimeo and so on.
Nice. Well, kudos to Rev for recognizing that AI was going to be the future and jumping on it early on, as opposed to companies like Blockbuster, who wanted to put out DVDs forever. Even when Netflix came around, started streaming things, you know, people may not want to have to go someplace to get their DVDs. Maybe they actually want to just stay in the house and get it right to their computers. But no, Blockbuster do better. We're going to continue. And now, can you find a Blockbuster? I think I even might have my Blockbuster card around here somewhere. I have no clue where it is, but they basically got taken out.
Yeah. We actually, that's funny. We definitely use that you know, story internally. I do think I have a Blockbuster card somewhere too. Yeah. Well, the nice thing too at Rev is that I do think that, you know, AI is very powerful, but the human in the loop factor is also super important, because for quality AI, you do want people to review the outcome of the model sometimes, right? And so Rev still offers this sort of blended service where you can choose to just have AI, but you can also choose to have, you know, higher quality that's reviewed. And it's kind of like an interesting new world where you can have these sort of superpower services.
Nice. You know, Miguel, when I first started this podcast, it had to do with, and it still does to this, in a sense, it had to do with talking to people like yourself and, you know, people with technical backgrounds about not just what they do, but how they communicate what they do. And it stemmed from even my own self. I used to work as an engineer, and I had to give presentations in front of people, management mostly, and I wasn't very good at it, but I saw the benefit of getting better at it, eventually at least. I certainly didn't see it after the first presentation I had to give, or the second, or the third, or the fourth for that matter, but I got the point eventually. So when it comes to the presentations or the speaking that you do, Miguel, was speaking always something you were good at? And if not, what'd you do to get better at it?
Yeah, good question. I mean, no, I think I felt very similar to you. The first few, you know, presentations were a bit of a drag, you know, and I mean, that my first job at Nuance, I was part of a group called Professional Services. And I think that helped, because Professional Services is this group of engineering and research that has to talk to customers way more than other groups, right? So I had a lot of customer meetings and so on. And so it gave me a lot of practice, but yeah, I always got nervous. I still do, you know, like, you know, before I talk to people, especially like, you know, bigger groups of people. But yeah, so I don't think I was always good, but, you know, practice makes perfect, I guess. So, you know, I think at some point there was a time where sort of inflection point where I started to enjoy, you know, speaking in public a bit more. But I wouldn't say like I'm no expert, you know, like I'm still learning, and especially in bigger crowds, I definitely have to practice and get ready, you know, before I get on in front of people. Yeah.
When it comes to the presentations that you do, do you have a process for putting them together? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, I enjoy speaking with usually, well, this sort of speaking I like a lot, but if I'm presenting something, I like to have a bit of a PowerPoint presentation sort of thing. So usually I prepare myself by writing a document, like what I'm going to say. I kind of like try to write it out. And I like pretty things. I like design, you know, so I like to prepare slides. I think that helps me prepare for the presentation a lot, because I spend a lot of time just preparing simple but pretty and simple and pretty slides that explain, you know, what I'm trying to say well. And like I really try to make them simple, and by trying to make them simple forces me to think about what I'm saying. And so I think between preparing the document, if people have questions for me, that helps, you know, so I prepare them the answers, and then preparing the slides, it's just like you know, helps me think about the subject I'm going to talk about a lot. And I think that's kind of my process. It's sometime, you know, tested out, you know, with my kids and wife or stuff like that, you know, but in general, I'm kind of like I like to just prepare by myself. Yeah.
I think design is important. I think when it comes to what you have on the slides, that's important too. I mean, when I first started giving presentations, I would have a whole lot of text on the slides so I could read them. And so I wouldn't have to remember what I was going to say. But what I found would happen is people wouldn't pay attention to what I was saying. They just read the slides too. And and then if I were to say something that wasn't on the slides, they'd miss it because they were too busy reading the slides. So what I did is I started using less text on slides. So people either have to listen or they're going to ignore me. I remove the option of them reading the slide because there's not a whole lot there to read. You'd look at a picture for as long as you want, but at some point you're going to probably not want to look at the picture anymore. You're going to switch to listening to what the person is saying, what I'm saying, or you're just going to ignore me because you don't care about what I'm saying. So hopefully I've engaged enough for you to actually care about it. But I firmly agree with having pretty things on slides. I think that's really helpful. Mm-hmm. You said that you write out your what you were going to say. Do you actually memorize those words, or is it just an exercise for you to really know your material?
Yeah, just an exercise. I think I did it at first thinking that I would memorize, but yeah, I don't have that good a memory, I guess, but it really does help me. Like, you know, I just write it down, and like to the point where other presentation, I really, you know, hello, my name is Miguel Jeté, you know, like today I'm going to, you know, and I just kind of write it out. But I think the exercise of writing it down just sort of like my brain will remember cues, you know, where I'm like, oh, okay, that's, and sometimes if it's on Zoom like this, I might like highlight a few of the key sentences in my text. And so I can kind of like quickly refer to it, you know, if I'm lost. But in general, just, yeah, the exercise of writing it down just helps me learn and remember my material.
Oh, okay, got you. Because when you first said it, I thought, man, is this guy actually memorizing all of his presentations? That's pretty impressive if you're able to do it. Because I also have a poor memory, so there's no way I would remember. And I think the issue you'd have with that is if you were to miss a word or two, now you might get thrown into a bit of a tailspin. What comes next? And then when you're thinking, what comes next? Now you're thinking as opposed to speaking, and people are looking at you thinking, what's coming next? You don't know what's coming next. Now I'm supposed to still listen to you? Yeah. This guy don't know what he's talking about. Man, I could have been doing something else.
yeah, for sure. Oh, no, you're right. Like it needs to flow, you know, and it needs to kind of like come from the heart a little bit when you're speaking. So, yeah, maybe some people learn stuff by heart, but you're right, for sure.
Do you ever get nervous before you give a presentation? And if so, how do you deal with your nerves?
Yeah, I mean, I do for sometimes. And I don't know if I have like a good way to get rid of it. I just kind of like reread my key points, you know, and like go through my slides. And I think with the experience, I know that those nerves turn into kind of energy as soon as you start speaking, you know. So it's like you just kind of know what to expect a little bit more, and you just, you know, live with it a little bit. But yeah, the nerves are always there. But I think they kind of disappear after, like, you know, a minute or so into your speech, right? So just knowing that, like, helps. But yeah, I just kind of focus on the presentation and the material and try to, like, forget about the nerves. I might have, you know, some water or, like, if it's early, some coffee, but coffee might not help so much with your nerves. So maybe water is better.
You know, when it comes to nerves, Miguel, I'm a big believer that if you don't have them, that might be a problem, because having them is a sign, at least to me, that you actually care about what you're talking about and you care about the outcome that you want the people in the audience to get. If you don't care, if you're not nervous, that's a sign to me that you don't really care about the outcome. And if you don't care about the outcome, if I'm an audience member, now I'm really mad, because I really could have been doing something else. This guy doesn't even care about what he's talking about. I'm supposed to care. You know what I care about? The fact that I'm missing lunch for this damn presentation. That's what I care about.
Yeah, yes. Lunch meeting. Yes, that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So I think, like, in that sense, you know, you try to, like, turn that nervous energy into, like, positive energy in your speech and so on. But yeah, you're right. It hopefully those nerves come from the right place of caring. And yeah, it's true.
Absolutely. When it comes to speaking, for the people who are listening to this conversation, Miguel, and they want to get better at their presentations or public speaking generally, what would your number one tip for them be?
Oh, I think just if you're worried about it, like, it's practice, right? So start small, you know, just practice, you know. So at work, when you have opportunities to speak, to present, you do it, you know. And I think you try to take care of, like we said earlier, you know, like, the more you care about what you're presenting, the easier it is. And so, you know, put some attention in your presentation, like, try to make it engaging and fun and cool. And, you know, just get in front of people and practice. I've never really done, like, any sort of, like, after work, you know, like, networking practice and stuff like that. Some people may find that, you know, useful. But in general, through work, I had enough opportunities to present that, you know, over time, I got better and better. You know, the first few time I presented at Rev, I spent a lot of time on my slides, just preparing. And I think it, you know, the more you prepare, the more ready you are and the less scary it is. And so, yeah, I think and overall, I think it's practicing that helps the most, you know.
Oh, 100%, Miguel. I mean, you can read all the books, listen to all the podcasts, watch all the YouTube videos you want, but if you don't actually get out there and practice this, you're not going to get better at it. And I'm a firm believer in that too. If it's something that you actually see the benefit of getting better at, you don't get better without the reps. And practice makes progress. I mean, what's the end destination of being a skilled public speaker? It's just being better than you were the last time you gave a speech, really. I mean, that's all we really can hope for or expect. So this has been a great conversation, Miguel. Thank you so much for being a guest. How can people get in touch with you?
Oh, good question. I mean, I'm on LinkedIn. I think my professional network is, you know, that's how usually people reach out to me. I'm also on Twitter I post sometimes on AI. I think my handle is a bit strange. I think if you look up Miguel Jeté LinkedIn, I think that's the best way to find me and to follow me and see what we do at Rev and what I do next.
Excellent. Well, everyone, that marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Thank you for being here and have a great day. Thanks, Miguel.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms, or on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.